Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm just going to have a little drink of this water. I've been sitting here thinking, oh, I can't wait to take a drink of that water. I'm so thirsty. How delicious is water? How precious is water? How important is water? Can't have life without water. But we seem not to be able to realize that sometimes. I'll get to that in a little bit, but let me start with my my opening. I just want to share, first of all, let me say thank you. I always love coming here. It's such an honor, Ron and all of you guys, to be here with you. I don't have to come here and defend a dogma. I don't come here and have to pontificate upon some doctrine. I can come here and share from my heart about my journey as a man who tries to be courageous in the face of all the challenges that we are encountering in this day and time, and that's a real blessing. It's a real blessing to be here with you, to share from my heart, to be with open hearts and kind, loving embraces, and I'm very, very grateful for that. And oh my goodness, what was that quotation from Dorothy Day? It could not have been better. We don't have the luxury of despair. There's too much work to be done. We must be people of hope. How powerful is that? Well, that's what I'm here to talk about today, hope. I want to talk about hope as it is interpreted by Paul Hawken in his beautiful little book, Blessed Unrest. If you haven't read that book, I highly recommend it. It's a great read, and it's so inspiring. And in a total agreement with Bob, we have to be intentional about what we think. That informs who we are, what we do. That informs our reality. It's very important to have that positive emotion, intellectual focus on the good, because that has significant repercussions. We got to place the emphasis on the right syllable, right? That syllable I want to share with you today is the syllable of hope. Who was it that spoke so eloquently in the 20th century about hope? It was none other than Václav Havel, the playwright who became the philosopher king in the Czech Republic. Václav Havel, the great courageous leader who endured so much persecution in a time of very complex, complex world of the former Soviet bloc, but yet someone who was whose own character was forged through the battles that he had to fight intellectually, emotionally, and in some measure physically. Václav Havel makes the distinction between hope and despair. I'd like to share with you a quotation, if you don't mind, from Dr. Havel. Hope is a state of mind, not of the world. Either we have hope or we don't. It is a dimension of the soul, and it's not essentially dependent on some particular observation of the world or estimate of the situation. Hope is not a prognostication. It is an orientation of the spirit, an orientation of the heart. It transcends the world that is immediately experienced and is anchored somewhere beyond its horizon. Hope in this deep and powerful sense is not the same as joy that things are going well or willingness to invest in enterprises that are obviously heading for success, but rather an ability to work for something just because it's good. Not because it stands a chance to succeed. The more propitious the situation in which we demonstrate hope, the deeper the hope is. Hope is definitely not the same thing as optimism. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense, regardless of how it turns out. Hope. And quotation from Paul Hawken, the author of Blessed Unrest. The 20th century saw the greatest rate of destruction of the environment in all recorded history. It was also the bloodiest century in history. 80 million were slaughtered from the beginning of the century through World War II. Since then, more than 23 million people, mostly civilians, have been killed in more than 149 wars. For every dollar spent on UN peacekeeping, $2,000 is expended for war making by the member nations. Four of the five members of the UN Security Council, which has veto power over all UN resolutions, are the top weapons dealers in the world: the United States, the United Kingdom, France, and Russia. Fixing the intractable problems besetting the world will require a convergence of social intelligence and natural science, two qualities that traditional politics lack. Makes me think of, I think it was Oscar Wilde who said, well, the way ahead is very difficult and I'm at a crossroads. On the left is total despair and on the right is complete cataclysm. I hope I have the wisdom to make the right choice. It can be overwhelming sometimes, right? When I feel overwhelmed, I am seduced by nostalgia. One of my vehicles for that seduction or that embrace is the TV series that probably none of you have heard about called Star Trek. In 1967, the last episode of the first season was entitled The City on the Edge of Forever. It was one of the two most critically acclaimed episodes of the series and was awarded the 1968 Hugo Award for Best Dramatic Presentation. In this episode of the Starship the crew of the Starship Enterprise discover a portal through space and time, which leads to Dr. McCoy, remember Bones? accidentally altering history. While the Federation starship is investigating temporal disturbances from a nearby planet, Lieutenant Sulu is injured in an explosion. Chief Medical Officer Dr. McCoy gives him a shot of chlorhexidine and accidentally injects himself with a near-fatal dosage by accident when the ship encounters the disturbance. So what does he do? He goes to the transporter room and beams himself down to this planet where the disturbance is happening. That's the way you set up the plot for Star Trek, right? Captain Kirk and his boys, and sometimes he'll have Lieutenant Sulu with him. They go down on the planet to save the day. So Kirk beams down a landing party to look for McCoy and finds the source of the problem. It's a time distortion taking place. It's an ancient glowing ring, an aperture the height of about the size of a human. The guardian of forever, this disembodied voice that you hear often in Star Trek, this guardian of forever explains that he is at a doorway to any time and any place. And while Spock is recording historic portal images, McCoy jumps through it, of course, and makes his way into the past miraculously. Suddenly, the landing party loses contact with the Enterprise, and they are informed that the past has been altered to such an extent that the USS Enterprise no longer exists. So they're trapped. Since the timeline must be repaired, the Guardian lets Kirk and Spock go after McCoy at the same image times, but they jump through the aperture also. But before they depart, Kirk tells the landing party that if they don't return, the rest of the landing party should go through the portal and land somewhere to make new lives for themselves in history, in the past, if he and Spock fail to return. Well, of course, they arrive in New York City, Depression era, 1930s, And after stealing some clothes to fit in, they meet a woman named Edith Keeler, who runs the 21st Street Mission. They offer to work for her. And while they're working, Spock secretly constructing a processor so he can figure out what the heck is going on and how to fix it. Kirk, of course, falls in love with the woman. It wouldn't be Star Trek, right? And he finds her just incredible. He's smitten with her. What happens is McCoy... I'm getting to the point, I promise. McCoy goes back in history, lands in on the street in New York City in 1930s, and this woman is about to be killed by an automobile barreling by, and McCoy saves her. But that alters history. So because she is spared, being the amazing person that she is, she lives to start a pacifist movement which influenced the United States sufficiently to delay its entrance into World War II, thus allowing Nazi Germany time to develop an atomic bomb and win the war. And in order for history to be righted, they must go back to the point of Edith's tragic death in that automobile accident and let it unfold. Well, I don't want to play spoiler for this episode of 50 years ago or 40 years ago, but suffice it to say, they figure it out, they get history corrected, and the crew of the Enterprise return to searching out new life forms and going boldly where no man has ever gone before. The seduction of nostalgia. It invites us to play the if-only game, doesn't it? If only I had done this, that wouldn't have happened. If only I had said this, that person would not have left. If only I had made this decision, the world would not have fallen apart. If only, if only, if only. You know, one of my if only games that I play, the scenarios that I run around, I play out in my mind is, you know, if only President Carter had been reelected, the solar panels on the White House would have stayed. They would not have been removed. And it would not have been announced that it's morning in America and we should drive the biggest cars we can imagine driving. If only that had happened that way, we would not have spent the previous 35 years addicted to cheap oil, an addiction that itself has been a significant cause of the climate disruption we see. If only, if only. If only. Well, the last time I was with you, I talked about forgiveness. And you'll recall probably, some of you possibly may recall, something I shared with you then. It's the bumper sticker of our nonprofit, the Gardens of Forgiveness. And it's a quotation by that great American philosopher, Lily Tomlin, who said that forgiveness means giving up all hope of a better past. Right? I have an advanced degree in trying to change the past, and I hadn't succeeded yet. Maybe you have too. You know, we can't change the past. We can't unring a bell. We can't turn back the hand on a clock. We have what we have, and that is our blessing. That is our opportunity. That is our challenge. Captain Kirk and the crew of the Enterprise may be able to travel back into the past and save the day or change history or write history, but we don't have a viable time machine. And even if we had one, well, that's a prospect that's even scarier than I want to think about. We have what we have, and it can be really scary. The theater of the absurd that is American politics. I mean, having Donald Trump as the front runner of one of the two political parties ruling the country, I don't know what to say about that. And I don't want to say that he's an isolated incident that just kind of happened. We created him. We are a part of why he's popular. Mea culpa. God help me when I find out what my part in that is. So many things. The islands, Fiji. Water shortages. Water being as precious as it is. I read Bill McKibben's book when I moved to California. It scared me to death. Earth. We don't live on the same planet we were born onto. We now live on Earth. E-A-A-R-T-H. Because it's different. He says that you have to channel your inner Arnold Schwarzenegger to pronounce it right. It's not Earth. It's Earth. With the harshness that that seems to imply. It's a scary place sometimes. But we live at the intersection of perhaps the most pivotal time in human history, and maybe every generation says that. I don't know. This is the only one I've ever lived in, unlike Captain Kirk and Dr. McCoy and Mr. Spock. Every generation maybe says that, but I think this is the most pivotal time humans have been alive, because at the same time we are learning such extraordinary things about other worlds that might have the capacity to create and engender and sustain life. At the same time we're making all these remarkable discoveries, we're destroying our own. It makes no sense. Makes no sense. So where is the woman of courage to stand in this time at this intersection of history? Where is the man of virtue to assert himself? Where is the existentialist hero or heroine to apply him or herself on that that continuum between hope and despair? Where are we? Where are we? In 2003, I was the angriest protester in Washington, screaming that we should not invade Iraq. Had a lot of competition, but I think I won out. I was so bitter. I was in despair. Not even Keith Olbermann, in his snarkiest tones, could pull me out of my funk. Then I read a little essay by a woman named Rebecca Solnit. She lives in the Bay Area. She writes some of the most profound stuff I've ever read. It's all available on the internet. Check her out, Rebecca Solnit. She wrote a little essay entitled Hope in the Dark. And in one swell foop, as we say, Rebecca gave me hope again. She says that hope is that thing. That experience of sitting in the dark before the wall and staying there as long as it takes until we can see where the cracks and the crevices are, where we'll put our feet as we climb over that wall of despair. Hope is an active virtue, not a passive funk. Hope is independent of worldly circumstances. It's a matter of the heart. It's a courageous act to be a person of hope, especially in what some would say is the darkest time we've faced. Surrounded by calamities right and left, there is, however, much reason for hope. Wow, you guys are getting solar panels. How cool is that? That's amazing that churches and fellowships and faith communities and communities of conscience are rising up. That gives me hope. That's a part of that movement that Paul Hawken talks about, that blessed unrest. That gives me hope. There are so many reinforcements for our hope. One of the most shocking and unexpected heroes of climate response to global climate disruption is the Pope. If you had told me that, I would have thought, well, that's the punchline for another one of those jokes. Pope Francis, daring to stand courageously in this moment and declare the truth of what is, but yet hold out hope for transformation, gives me so much hope. Locally, in a time when hate crimes seem to run rampant, the families of the Charleston Nine, the nine good people in Charleston who were seeking to be better people by prayer and fellowship and Bible study, were gunned down, killed in cold blood by a terrorist of white supremacy. The families of those victims have chosen to forgive. Wow. That gives me hope. They chose to forgive not because he deserves it, because they know that hate is too great a weight to bear, and they want to free themselves from revenge fantasies and from any idea that violence begetting violence does any good in the world. These are courageous people, and they give me hope. Mind you, forgiveness doesn't mean letting people off the hook for doing bad things. They're not letting them off the hook, but they are letting themselves off the hook. And they're stopping, they're breaking the cycle of violence and revenge here in this moment. And miracles happen when people do things like that. The flag came down in Colombia. Maria and I were there for that. I was there as a young priest 25 years ago marching, saying, "Bring down the flag." And so they did. They put it even closer to your face to rub your nose in it. It's 20 feet off the ground, not on top of the state house. And it remained there for decades. But it's down now, due in some measure, I'm convinced, to the courageous act of these families to forgive and to break that cycle of violence and revenge. And what about Bree Newsom, this African-American wonder woman, this beautiful young woman who, as a freedom fighter, said, "I'm going to take it down." And her partner, this young man, Tyson, Stephen Tyson, I believe is his name. Wow, this gives me hope. This is the blessed unrest that Paul Hawken talks about. We live in a time fraught with danger and calamity. But as President Kennedy once, wrongly, but it makes for a beautiful story, asserted that the Chinese word for crisis is made up of two words, danger and opportunity. So we are in a time where we face both danger and opportunity. And just as things seem to be going to hell in a proverbial handbasket, there is also emerging this new movement of grassroots activism all over the world, this blessed unrest where hundreds of thousands of NGOs, faith communities, leaderless organizations are standing up to do something locally to build resilience in their communities and make a difference, and the aggregate is extraordinary. Hawken describes this movement as the planet's immune system, warding off the disease of greed, warding off the disease of violence. They literally are changing the world. So how are you all today? I want to get to the homiletic moment of the talk. How are you all today? Where is your hope? Where are you on that continuum of hope and despair? How goes it, as we might say? Ted Myers is one of my heroes, a theologian and activist who teaches in California, and he describes his own tutelage under the Berrigan brothers in Baltimore as being summarized by a poster that hung on their very tattered hallways of their building, and it said this: "The most apostolic of all duties is to encourage one another, to keep one another's hope up." So how are you with your hope today, my brothers and sisters? My hope and my prayer and my intention, the intention of my heart, is that in something I might have said, in something that you are already doing, you will find renewed hope, renewed commitment, resurgence in the doing of right, to stand up and look at the despair in the world and be willing to joust as if it were the windmill, but to stand. You know, sometimes we have to stand up and stand against, not necessarily even that we change what we're standing against, but that in our standing, we ourselves are not changed or co-opted. In later this year, we will commemorate the ending of a war 20 years ago in one beautiful city on the edge of forever, a city that was known as the Jerusalem of Europe, the Jerusalem of the Balkans, Sarajevo, and the siege of Sarajevo that killed so many people. It was a place where it was the only major European city to have a mosque, a Catholic church, an Orthodox church, and a synagogue in the same neighborhood. I may be a little bleary-eyed this morning because I was up late at a birthday party last night, but it was great that I was there because it gave me the way to wrap up my talk this morning. My dear friend David Lamott, some of you probably have heard him. He's a singer-songwriter. He wrote a song called "Just One Candle" after he had gone to Sarajevo right after the war, and he describes his experience of being there after the war. He found himself singing in a basement choir room where a peace choir made up of Muslims, Jews, Christians had come together to sing one another's sacred songs as a pathway to healing and peace. I want to share with you the words, snippet of the words of that song. It's a palpable image of the hope that can inspire and transform us, the blessed unrest that can sweep us and is sweeping us from despair and filling us with renewed hope. "Just One Candle." The closest I've flown to the face of war was in Sarajevo on a wing and a prayer. The shells didn't fly from the hills anymore, but the people were haunted and fear was in the air. The city was cratered from the shells and the rounds like rain on a puddle, like the face of a moon. They buried the bodies till they filled up the ground and the grass on the highway, till they just ran out of room. But the people have gathered in the middle of town with songs they hold sacred of a time coming soon. From their different traditions, they are singing the sound of their future together, and they're singing in tune. All the darkness in the world can't extinguish the light of just one candle, just one candle. All the darkness in the world can't extinguish the light of just one candle. You can shrug and say love is a powerless tool, that the real world is heartless, and that hope is for fools, but I've watched the sun rise, and the truth I've found, it's not light that's fragile, it's the other way around. All the darkness in the world can't extinguish just one candle. May we all be inspired by this vision, this blessed unrest, empowered by this hope, to work for the day when our water will be returned to its cleanliness, when our environment, insofar as it is capable of being restored, is restored, when the lion will lay down with the lamb, when the poor will have food to eat, when the blind will have sight, and the healing that you and I dream of, and speak of, and sing about, and share with each other will be manifest in the world. Amen.